Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine, the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Last week, we were looking at the impact of World War II on English towns, and also briefly touching on, as a further example of the particular nature of disruption, although very different in character, of course, post-war rebuilding and other associated policies, government control, new towns, etc. And this today, we're going to move into the second half of the century. Now, for more of our listeners, we're coming closer all the time to not just memory, but also, of course, recovered memory through parents or indeed grandparents. And, you know, some of what I might say people may disagree with, which is fine. The whole point about The Critic is we stand for debate, differences of opinion, and mature discussion, which is evidence-based. But what I want to start with is a passage from 1954, which reminds us that not just the past is a different country, but that things within our lifespan could be very different. It was rather like a slow motion picture. That was the fog, of course. Nothing could really move in a fog like this. The buses would be stopped and the cars, and the people who were abroad, by which they meant abroad out of their houses, would crawl like beetles and wish to be home again. And the watches and clocks would all slow down. The last, of course, a lovely phrase. The nightmarish quality of a smog, the acme of atmospheric pollution for that period, was captured in the description of London in Patricia Wentworth's novel Lady's Bane of 1954. Smogs, of course, were a key element in the collective imagination of town life in the beginning of our period, not least in London. And I mean, I can remember what used to be called a pea super. I can remember it at the top of Edgebury Lane and the difficulty of even envisaging crossing what is now the A41. But it's one that was to disappear by its close. Indeed, I think it's fair to say that, you know, I was emphasising last week bomb damage and the previous week housing policy and new housing. I think it's fair to say environmental change was a major factor in urban life. And indeed, what's ironic is we're usually encouraged to think that all was all today is in the worst of all possible ways. But actually, there has been a considerable improvement in certainly the visual clarity of urban life. The first smokeless zone legislation was introduced in the Manchester Corporation Act of 1946. A smokeless zone was established in Coventry in 1951, and controls spread rapidly from the mid-1950s. Shock horror for those who think the Conservatives are always awful. We're talking about a Conservative government then. With a Clean Air Act of 1956, followed by another in 1968. Central heating replaced coal fires. And from the 1960s, gas came in pipelines from the natural gas fields in the North Sea and was no longer made from coal, ensuring that what was called the gasworks became a part of town lost to memory as it was redeveloped. The pools of smoke that used to hang about towns went. Another aspect that's worth talking about, one that is much more sensitive, of course, was the pronounced nature of ethnic change, which was very much the case in many, not all, towns and affected their composition, both, as it were, religious composition and other aspects as well. Ethnic change was overwhelmingly urban and was particularly pronounced in London, the Midlands, Lancashire and Yorkshire, but far less so in the towns of the northeast, such as Newcastle, or the southwest. So Sunderland and Plymouth were not exactly towns in this period that had a large number of immigrants. Indeed, I've been at Exeter since 1996, and I can recall from many years ago, a university dinner in which one of the guests was the then deputy chief constable. There were two, in fact, but one of the deputy chief constables. And he said, you know, Home Office regulations had come through insisting that the force, Devon and Cornwall force, tried to increase the number of ethnic minority officers, and that he'd set out to do that, and he'd gone to see the two principal ethnic minority communities as then were in Devon. And he'd found, number one was the University of Exeter, where there were a large number of people who were postgraduates, particularly from the Middle East, who had absolutely no interest whatsoever in joining the police. They were interested in getting good jobs back in the Gulf. The other particular group was, there was a significant Chinese community in Plymouth, and he'd gone down there and there'd been a lunch with the community elders, as it were, and he said they courteously explained to me that being a policeman was a very undesirable and low status occupation. So that was Exeter some time ago. The situation has changed now. From the 1950s, in particularly the towns that I was talking about, London, the Midlands, Lancashire and Yorkshire, there was large-scale immigration from the new Commonwealth, especially the West Indies and South Asia. Many of the immigrants intended only a limited stay, but the vast majority actually did stay. A temporary labour shortage in unattractive spheres of unemployment, such as transport, especially the buses, and nursing, led to an active sponsorship of immigration that accorded with the Commonwealth idealism of the period. I think it's fair to say that black people encountered severe discrimination in the housing market, as well as much personal hostility, a theme, for example, explored in the film Pool of London, 1951, where a Jamaican merchant seaman is a key character. If you see the film, it's worth seeing. The other thing, of course, which is very noticeable, is the idea that the Pool of London should be still a major centre of maritime trade. That was to be killed by the trade union. Many immigrants found landlords unwilling to accept them as tenants. The cooking smells of West Indians and Indians were criticised, while the former were condemned unfairly, on the whole, for loud parties and sexual immorality. Racism played a role in neighbourhoods and workplaces, and white flight, to take a phrase from the United States, came to be involved in the housing pattern, an underreported theme that has continued to the present day. And very noticeably so in movements within the country. Notting Hill in London in 1958 witnessed a race riot with white thugs attacking recently settled blacks. There's quite a lot of fairly good reporting of the time on what went on. And there's also some fairly good coverage in some novels, which in a way recreate and impressions. I noticed recently Dominic Nolan's novel White City includes a significant section set during those riots. In response, the Notting Hill Carnival was started the following year, whilst Oswald Mosley, the sort of fascistic would-be leader, failed in his attempt to exploit the immigration issue during the 1959 electoral campaign. At the same time, the limited incorporation of West Indians into the community was shown in that election. Of the 7,000 West Indians who were entitled to vote in the parliamentary constituency of North Kensington, always an area less well off than what people tend to think of as Kensington High Street, of those 7,000, only 1,000 did so. Much of the initial new Commonwealth immigration was from the West Indies, particularly Jamaica, but South Asia, both India and Pakistan, subsequently became more important. Areas such as Southall came to seem little Indias to other Londoners, and the railway station there has Indian signs. Due to immigration, there were significant variations in settlement patterns across London and many other towns. For example, whereas over 10% of the population of six London boroughs in 1991 were of Indian background, the boroughs being Hounslow, Ealing, Brent, Harrow, Redbridge and Newham, 13 other boroughs had a percentage smaller than 2.5%. The concentration in the case of Bangladeshis was more pronounced, with over 10% of the population in Tower Hamlets being Bangladeshi, replacing a previous significant number of Jews who had moved out, mostly to northwest London. Over 5% of Bangladeshis in Newham and Camden, but fewer than 1% in most other boroughs. From the late 1990s, Tower Hamlets promoted the Brick Lane area as London's curry capital, and Banglatown, an idea originating in the late 1980s and reflecting the approximately 80,000 British citizens of Bangladeshi heritage living there. Brick Lane became the stereotypical cultural centre for successive waves of immigration. Huguenots, Jews, Bangladeshis. Less attractively, there were also issues to do with corruption and one-party state, etc., in Tower Hamlets, issues that have cropped up recently as well. Additional immigrant flows into London included Vietnamese to Hackney in the 1980s and Iraqis to northwest London in the 1990s and 2000s. In an immigration that began in the 1970s, over 10,000 South Koreans live in the Koreatown in New Malden, which includes restaurants, food markets, and travel agencies. Yemenis congregate near Warwick Avenue. Now, these are examples of the range of new Londoners with their distinctive experiences. People not born in Britain have become the majority of Londoners, while about 5% of London's population allegedly are illegal immigrants, which is obviously a group that tends to be undercounted in censuses. Many flee hardship to find broken expectations, which of course would be the immigrant perspective. I think it's fair to say that others can be disconcerted by what they see as significant changes to the areas they live in. And that is a view held both in towns, but also by people in other parts of the country who can feel that these towns are, quote, not English. Not a view that is accurate, because, of course, the people themselves are British citizens on the whole, unless they're illegal immigrants, but on the whole are British citizens. But there are ideas of behaviour that do not always seem to match that assumption. These are tricky areas, but it's worth saying that they're an important part of the discussion of modern urban life, both the public discussion and the private discussion. And the job of the historian, whatever their own views, is to actually take note of both the themes in the public discussion and the themes in the private discussion. London itself faced the major social burden of coping with half the net international immigration affecting the United Kingdom. And partly as a result of this immigration, London's population, which had risen to about 8.7 million by 1938 before falling to 8.2 million in 1951 and 6.7 million in 1988, as large numbers moved to new housing in the outer metropolitan area, it then bounced up to reach 9.3 million in 2020. These were very significant changes in individual, aggregate and percentage terms, changes that helped to contextualise, if not characterise, the experience of being a Londoner or a member of a London-linked network. Novelists presented London as a central site for a change in racial composition. In Agatha Christie's novel Hickory Dickory Dock, and lots of people stupidly say that Agatha Christie just wrote about rural villages or country houses. It's absolute drivel, that approach. Anyway, in her novel Hickory Dickory Dock, 1955, Miss Lemon's sensible sister, Mrs. Hubbard, becomes warden of a London student hostel. Miss Lemon commenting, "These students at the hotel, at the hostel, are of all nationalities, some of them actually black." "Naturally," said Hercule Poirot. "Half the nurses in our hospitals seem to be black nowadays," said Miss Lemon doubtfully, "and I understand much pleasanter and more attentive than the English ones." In his novel The Worm of Death, 1961, Nicholas Blake, that's a pseudonym for Cecil Day Lewis, who obviously becomes poet laureate, presented Nelly, a perceptive former Docklands prostitute who takes in lodgers. They're nice boys, most of them, don't give any trouble, particularly the spades. I'm glad you don't have a colour bar. Not me, she chuckled comfortably. Nelly, the ever open door, that's me. We're all the same underneath the skin, I always say. Spades being a phrase at that stage for people who were black, as in the Ace of Spades. More generally, change to urban life came at a greater pace in the late 20th century, in part because towns, as I mentioned, became multi-ethnic, and in part due to the need to respond to population growth as a whole, which owed much to immigration, not only to immigration, and the resulting demand for new houses. The population rose in each census radically to higher figures. Existing towns increased in size, some greatly so, for example, Bristol, which after London was the major English town with the highest rate of increase, whereas conversely, Liverpool had the lowest of the major towns. Smaller towns could also expand greatly, for example, Exmouth. At the present moment, Exeter, where I live, is expanding in population terms by 8% every census period. That's every 10 years. There was also the establishment of new towns, albeit not always successfully, and with scant interest in the views of residents. While Milton Keynes, the fastest growing economy outside London between 1997 and 2011, was economically a success, as was Harlow and Stevenage, others, such as Peterlee in County Durham, translated old social problems to new, poorly planned sites. There's also Telford in Shropshire failed to fulfil its original promise. The low-density model of garden cities that had been the basis for new towns, of which 14 were designated by the 1945 to 51 Labour governments, was replaced from the 1950s, first in a conservative reaction that owed much to wariness about the costs and political impact of more new towns, and then from the 1960s, due to a what I think one might call modernist emphasis on greater housing densities. So the Labour Party's fascination, Labour governments in 1964 to 70, fascination with tower blocks. In turn, under Mrs. Thatcher, new town development corporations were chopped in the 1980s, only for the idea to be revived in the early 21st century, in part due to support from Charles, Prince of Wales, now Charles III, but also from the 2010s due to the pressure to address housing provision. Elected in 2024, Labour pledged to introduce more new towns, partly in order to fulfil its bold promises, though it's not by any means clear that there's enough skilled labour in the country to provide adequate quality. This was a different model of provision to, say, the new towns of the medieval period, which had largely been the creation of local landowners. Instead, the situation was more similar to that under the Romans, though I doubt that's a comparison that will recommend itself to the new government. Old or new, town planning became far more significant as an issue for both individuals and communities. You've only got to listen to people's conversation. Multi-story car parks disfigured many townscapes, sometimes also those showing up in a rather interesting ways in films. If those of you who know Get Carter, which is set obviously in Newcastle, will know the person thrown off the car park there. And I noticed that this idea of using, you know, car parks, multi-story car parks, and indeed multi-story skyscrapers for these purposes has now become quite an axiom in many films. In terms of the skyscrapers, you can see it in the recent Guy Ritchie film, The Gentleman. Pressures for bypasses grew, and the towns that gained them, such as Honiton in 1966, or also in my part of the world, Axminster and Ashburton, became more attractive places to live. Although I think it's fair to, well, Exeter, which where they never completed the ring road, has the most appalling traffic problem. But Newbury in Berkshire was not alone in having a bypass that was too close to the town centre, so that it was absorbed into the road network and didn't help reduce traffic there. Ring roads within towns were far less attractive. Carlisle's, which opened in 1974, cutting the castle off from the city and being followed by the replacement of a long-established area by a shopping centre. In Wolverhampton, there was comparable damage. I stayed a night in Wolverhampton about 3 or 4 years ago to speak in a conference. And I mean, the people are very, very pleasant, but it's certainly a city that has been wrecked by developers and planners. Inner city motorways brought great, albeit localized, destruction for many in London and Newcastle. But on the other hand, there were not the marshalling yards or large railway stations comparable to those for trains. I used to say that the inner city motorway in Newcastle was designed to keep business up for the hospital. In contrast, the cuts under the reshaping of British Railways 1963, a report better known to you and I as the Beeching Report, led many towns to lose their rail links, including Bideford, Buckingham, and Ilfracombe, while former junctions instead found themselves served only by a single line. In contrast, there was a supplementing on a long-standing pattern of rail links in the London area. This was most pronounced as a result of the tube additions. Thus, Ealing on the Great Western Railway line to Paddington had acquired a district line service in 1880, the Central in 1920, and then the Piccadilly. The London Underground stations at Ealing Broadway merged with the Great Western Railway station in the 1960s. There was also a dedicated line built to Heathrow. One's thinking there of the Heathrow Express, which has now been followed by the Elizabeth Line, or a branch of the Elizabeth Line. The closure of rail services essentially hit small town and rural England, and introduced by the Conservatives and backed by Labour, engaged relatively little national political interest. In contrast, the ownership of houses became a significant political issue, and indeed a major aspect of the Thatcherite so-called revolution of the 1980s. And the context is important. The 1915 Rent and Mortgage Interest War Restrictions Act, foreigners take note, those are the sort of titles that interest that British legislation tends to have or had, which owed something to concern about rent strikes. As a result of it, private land ownership had become less profitable, tenant rights more secure, and renting from local authorities, what in Britain was called council housing, more important. Partly due to the fair rent system, which allowed rent officers to fix rents below the market level, supposedly to protect tenants from rapacious landlords, the private rental sector fell greatly from the majority at the mid-20th century to less than 10% by 1988, which greatly lessened the flexibility of the property market and helping to stoke up demand for owner occupation. Indeed, the critics of what they called Thatcherite policies, such as council house sales, never really asked the question, well, why are people trying to buy houses? And one of the reasons was that the nature of government regulation of the private rental market had made it very unprofitable for people to own properties that were put out to rent, which I fear is going to happen again. Meanwhile, the Greenwood Housing Act of 1930, named after the person responsible for it, gave local authorities power to clear or improve what were called slum areas, though crowded and substandard housing. And after 1945, slums were swept aside and their inhabitants moved into new publicly owned housing estates. These were reflections of the priority given to rehouse people after the war and to create an acceptable living environment, although many of the available resources had initially instead to be devoted simply to repairing the war-damaged housing stock. Prefabricated methods of construction ensured that new housing, including multi-story blocks of flats, could be built rapidly, and local councils such as Gateshead and Newcastle in the 1960s took pride in their number, the size and the visibility. Moreover, municipal housing policies helped in the consolidation of Labour's electoral base. Set in the Potteries, Mary Kelly's novel The Spoil Kill of 1961 captured the changes. Quote, new colleges, factories, offices, thrusting sheer above surrounding waves of low slate roofs that dipped and sagged with age. Progress and consciousness were gradually but ineluctably sponging down the past. An improvement, of course. But it was impossible not to murmur occasionally from the deep, forgetful, rosy well of sentiment, a sad farewell to the old bottle ovens and the soot. Well, extolled at the time and illustrated alongside castles and cathedrals in guidebooks of the 1960s, municipal multi-story flats were subsequently to be attacked as ugly, out of keeping with the existing urban fabric, of poor quality, as lacking in community feeling, and as breeders of alienation and crime. I think it's fair to say that urban culture, in the sense of attitudes to urban living, and after all, by whom, you might say, is often difficult to recover. So it's reasonable to point out that the attitudes of the 1950s towards modern dense housing schemes have been affected by subsequent perceptions. In practice, many of the buildings of the 1950s were relatively generous with space, certainly compared with earlier slum housing, the sole experience on offer for most people, and they often provided people with their first bathrooms and inside toilets. I think it's reasonable to say that the problems of poorly built estates were more apparent from the 1960s, whereas earlier examples were frequently better built and more popular. From the 60s, there was also more concern about the dispiriting character of the new urban environment, although the issue of housing provision was affected by poverty. Moreover, the failure of many tower block estates designed as communities with elevated walkways called streets in the sky may have owed more to the absence of a social cohesion rather than to poor planning. That's being charitable. Coherent and long-lasting neighbourhoods were swept away. So the area known as Little Italy in Manchester was broken up by slum clearance in the early 1960s. And I think it's worth saying, if you want to see first-rate dense housing within the British world in the 1960s and 70s, in my view, you should look not to a British city, but you should look to the high-rise new towns built in the new territories of Hong Kong from the 1970s, such as Sha Tin. And they avoided many of the social problems seen in England in schemes of this type. At the same time, even the most vexed schemes in Britain were integrated into wider networks with the provision of electricity, gas and telephone, while many new council houses were still low-rise suburban estates built to the interwar Parker Morris standards, for example, the Middlefield Lane estate in Gainsborough. Meanwhile, the continuing housing crisis was seen with the number of young single adults and young couples still living with their parents, which of course has recurred now, and this acted as a prompt to new building, as did political promises made by both political parties, major political parties, and generally fairly foolish. There were constants across towns in the shape of government policy and national regulation. But housing was also affected by specific civic cultures. Although in practice, that means the views of councillors and planners in particular towns, rather than those of tenants or potential tenants. I think it's fair to say that in those areas that were one party pocket boroughs, a lot of the northern cities were Labour pocket boroughs, the views of tenants or potential tenants was assumed rather than listening to. Indeed, both the latter groups were patronised and, in general, their opinions ignored. At the level of individual towns, there were also the major variations caused by land availability, financial muscle, and the support or opposition of neighbouring councils, whether urban or not. So Manchester had seen flats as un-English, and in other words, they'd seen them as continental, which was a view widely held in the interwar period. Flats were associated in particular with cities like Vienna and Berlin. And Manchester had in that period pursued a garden suburbs policy, for example, at Wythenshawe. But it was obliged, due to the opposition of other neighbouring local authorities, both Conservative and Labour, and the cost and shortage of land in the post-war period, to build up. In part, though, that also reflected a new culture of modernity, which led to estates, notably at Hume, which rapidly faced major structural and social problems. Indeed, the Hume Crescent's estate, constructed in 1972, was abandoned in 1984 and demolished in 1993 before being replaced by low-rise and medium-rise housing. A lot of the housing built in public housing built in Sheffield was similarly inadequate. Moreover, alongside the municipal housing, there was also a brutal modernist rebuilding of many town centres, as in Birmingham, Manchester, and Newcastle, with both political parties supporting the process. Already in 1951, W.H. Auden had referred in his poem, The Chimeras, to, quote, absence of heart, as in public buildings. Anxiety about, and justified anxiety, about the destruction of past towns led to the foundation of the Victorian Society in 1958, but much was torn down in the 1960s. Losses in Manchester included the Milne Building and Cavendish Street Independent Chapel, while in Newcastle, most of Eldon Square made way for a shopping centre. Modernist functionalism drove the pace of architectural development, as with Richard Seaford's uncompromising slab-like centre point site skyscraper in central London, built in 1967, and still, you know, where Oxford Street meets Tottenham Court Road, and still jolly ugly. Erno Goldfinger, after whom Ian Fleming named a Bond villain, was responsible for modernist horrors, including Trellick Tower, also in London. This modernism was seen in hospitals, schools, and other buildings, as well as in housing. Ironically, although it claimed to be functional, it was far from functional, not least due to a misguided preference for flat roofs, a mistaken design in a rainy climate. I mean, taking a look at Boisier-style architecture and trying to extrapolate it in the, you know, pleasant Mediterranean calm of the climate of most British cities was stupid. Concrete cladding also frequently proved a problem. The combination of developers, planners, and town councils often produced a trashy rebuilding. I mean, it's worth pointing out that in many cities, it was suggested that corruption played a major role. I mean, that was W.G. Hoskins's argument about the situation in Exeter. And in the case of Newcastle, the running of the city by T. Dan Smith was linked to corruption, Labour Party, one party state, etc., etc. Or you have the situation in County Durham, where Alderman Cunningham of the planning committee was sent to prison for corruption to do with building contracts. I mean, it's notable, of course, as a classic example of the British system of the period, that Cunningham had been to a particular Cambridge college, that he was tried and convicted by a court with a graduate of the same college sitting as judge, and he was sent to prison where somebody from the same college was governor. In Agatha Christie's Third Girl, which came out in 1966, quote, the old-fashioned market town is assailed by, quote, progress in the shape of a new supermarket. in the 20th and 21st centuries, there was a much repeated complaint about the growing sameness of town centres, with architectural trends and the decline of independent shops both presented as key causes of a development that owed much to a reliance on private capital. But in fact, one I think can fairly say that this problem was more widespread than that of simple a kind of private functionalism, private capital functionalism. There was also very much the imprimatur of political approval and planning. The economic downturn that followed the 1973 oil price hike provided more protection for the townscape than legislation such as the Town and Country Planning Act of 1969. At any rate, modernism as a strategy, culture, and process was increasingly discarded. Now, I wonder whether it will come back again with this new government. In May 1984, the future Charles III, speaking at a gala evening of the Royal Institute of British Architects, complained that his audience had, quote, consistently ignored the feelings and wishes of the mass of ordinary people in this country, and left the towns with, quote, concrete stumps and glass towers. I think King Charles, or the future King Charles's comments were well justified. Of course, the architects were outraged, but then they were pompous prats. In addition, there were more numerous segments of society hostile towards the central process of governmentally driven urban change. In pursuit of what it called a property-owning democracy, the Conservative governments of the 1950s fostered owner occupation and restricted rent control. In turn, the Right to Buy Housing Act of 1980, also passed by a Conservative government, introduced the sale of council housing to tenants, which expanded home ownership, but also depleted the stock of public housing. Whereas in 1914, 10% of the housing stock was owner-occupied, by 2000, the percentage, and of a far larger stock, was 70%. Furthermore, the fair rent system was abolished, which encouraged a revival in private renting. And if I can just close on that point, but I just want to give you the percentage. This is for England and Wales. So owner-occupiers, 1914 was 10%. 1939, as a consequence of the massive expansion of interwar suburbia, was 31%. 1966, it was up to 47%. 1977 to 54%, 1985 to 62%, and 1990 to 67%. During that period, that rented from local authority had risen from 1% in 1914 to 32% in 1977, before falling to 24% in 1990. So very major changes. Graham, I wonder whether, you know, obviously I'm going to press on next time, but I want in particular to talk about some aspects of urban culture. I know you were wishing to hear me speak on the Beatles, and you will actually find that I will try and do so. But is there anything so far that you'd like to have a go at?
Yes, well, not have a go at, but just get your thoughts about, Jeremy. And actually, I'd like to start really with that last point you're making about the decline over the course of the 20th century of private rental, and certainly until the 1990s, of private rental and increase of privately owned residences. Do we have a sense, and obviously there's going to be variety from place to place, but do we have a sense of whether the decline in private rentals ended up being houses which were then became privately owned residences? Or are we seeing those private rental houses being knocked down in the various waves of redevelopment, and actually the privately owned sector is often new builds?
Yes, I think it's very much a lot is knocked down. Remember, they weren't necessarily just simply single houses. Many of them were multi-occupancy buildings, rooming houses, tenement houses. So that if you took down several of those, you'd be taking down a significant amount of the local, of the percentage. I think that's a point I would try and make. But yes, there was a lot of destruction, but also one of the classic situations is where that somebody who owns a property no longer feels that it is worth their while renting it out, sells it to a developer, it is then knocked down. Now that's different from what you might call a compulsory purchase or war damage. So it can be a whole host of reasons why the nature of property activity changes. I mean, again, to give you some percentages, 80% rented from private landlords in 1914, 23% in 1939, 15% in 1966, 7% by 1990. So, these are very significant changes. Of course, what's interesting is that you're going to, and I will be talking about this, you're going to get the changes in housing provision that you get with housing associations. And you're also going to get, I mean, a particular issue, of course, is the liquidity necessary. If you're to put down a deposit, and the difficulty that renting from local authority, unless you're a group which there's a statutory requirement on the local authority to house you, if you're transient, this shift doesn't really work well. So if you're, for example, let's say somebody from Wakefield, and you have the prospect of temporary job in, let us say, Horsham, becomes very difficult with the squeezing and diminution of things like rooming houses and so on to actually find a place where you can live. So in a sense, what you get is a the housing market becomes very, very, very static. And that's a real problem for the economy as a whole.
What do we know about the politicization of this process in terms of rent controls, effectively driving private renters out of the market because they couldn't get the return on investment they sought? What would you say this is? And of course, these rent controls were both Conservative and Labour administrations. But would you say there was a motivating factor to deliberately drive out the private rental market so that there would be a high demand for council housing, or is that too crude?
Well, I think what's really ironic is you had the situation with, I can't remember her name, but who got into trouble for and was fined very heavily, Lady Porter, I think,
Yes, in
in
Westminster Council.
Westminster for, Westminster Council for allegedly, just for the benefit of listeners who don't know, and you correct me, it was alleged that she had taken steps in ploughing policy to try and ensure that the council area was conservative, through the and she got into trouble, was fined heavily, all the rest of it. Well, what is ironic, I mean, is this was the kind of policy that had been going on for decades with Labour, urban magnificos, with no sort of comeback at all. Yes, I don't think there's any doubt that there was a hostility to private ownership. There was a hostility to the idea of return on capital. There was a very ignorant assumption that you could create a benign, almost semi-utopian situation through enforced communal public ownership. And the practicality, of course, was that there were advantages and disadvantages for individuals and for communities. And some of, obviously, the changes that occurred did produce, as I've mentioned, people having their first bathrooms, their first internal loos, a degree of privacy. All of these are desirable. Others, I think it's fair to say, are not so desirable. But, you know, there are different things to think about in this. I mean, I myself feel that the argument that the state knows best is not has not been demonstrated by the last 100 years of British history. But obviously, other people will take a different perspective. We might, at the end of this series, have a discussion about this point.
Well, these are all very much hot topics, particularly now that we have a government which looks set to make private rental market more difficult, more burdensome, but also to encourage council housing again. So I think we will return to this debate at the conclusion of the series, because it's certainly very topical. But for talking us through this period in the development of the English town, Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.